a great documentary
makes us question everything. The things that we know and the things we think we know.
But we're actually completely wrong about.
This is the beginning of my last act. In order to know how to go forward, I'm going to have to know where I've been.
The public figures we love.
And love to hate.
The issues that we must face as a society.
Huge cultural moments.
I mean, as a black man, you're born into this world with PTSD.
Things you can't unsee.
The aftermath is worse than the actual levees breaking.
Someone who's different from us, but also
not that different from us.
Somebody offers you $1 million, you're gonna take it.
Documentaries show us the worst
and the best
of what human beings are capable of.
Comedy is about the present and the now, and then life changes and you hopefully, as a comedian, change and evolve with it.
Welcome to HBO Docs Club, where we dive deep into the true stories that captivate our imaginations. I'm Brittany Luce, documentary superfan and freelance journalist.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr., live storyteller and cultural commentator. On each episode of HBO Docs Club, we take a closer look at a film or series in the HBO documentary films catalog. Sometimes they're from our recent past, other times they're brand new, but they all inevitably teach us something about the human condition.
Now, I know in our last episode, we said we'd cover the Apollo, but HBO premiered a new docuseries on May 21st, and we wanted to talk about it ASAP. So don't worry, we'll get to the Apollo for our season finale. But today, we're bringing you a very special episode about a very special comedian.
You have to be somewhat of an egotist to stand up all your life and say, listen to me, please pay attention. And that's fine, I can live with that about myself. But if I'm going to call attention to myself, I want to show them something a little different from time to time. I want to find a voice that isn't like all the others. So I like to find out where their line may be and deliberately cross it and then make them glad they came.
George Carlin's American Dream is an intimate look at Carlin's amazing life and career. And in today's episode, we sit down with the directors of the two-part documentary, Judd Apatow and Mike Bonfiglio.
Apatow and Bonfiglio have previously collaborated on multiple documentaries, including The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling and May It Last, A Portrait of the Avett Brothers, which is a personal favorite of mine. Both films are available to stream on HBO Max.
All right, and here's our interview with Judd Apatow and Mike Bonfiglio. Judd, you posted this clip on Twitter about the rich dividing the poor and middle class and said of Carlin, he was always ahead of everyone else. Let's take a listen.
That's the way the ruling class operates in any society. They try to divide the rest of the people. They keep the lower and the middle classes fighting with each other so that they, the rich, can run off with all the fucking money. Fairly simple thing happens to work. You know, anything different, that's what they're going to talk about. Race, religion, ethnic and national background, jobs, income, education, social status, sexuality, anything they can do, keep us fighting with each other so that they can keep going to the bank.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Doesn't it? Yes. Related to that, Judd, why do you think Carlin's words here are so pertinent today?
He just trends on Twitter all the time. Yeah. Even though there's so much stuff out there, for some reason, when something happens in the news, he trends. And it's weird because most comedians, their material gets stale really fast. We don't listen to the comedy albums of people from the 70s and the 60s anymore. And his seems to matter more. So there's something timeless about him.
Literally this morning, he was trending on Twitter. Before we released the trailer or anything, he was trending.
I mean, I think when we see what's happening in Florida right now with the Don't Say Gay laws, we see how polarized the country is. You know, this is what he warned people about, which was basically wedge issues. And I think he found a way to encapsulate that that really reaches people. Does it affect them when they get to the ballot box? Who knows? But I think he was trying to find ways to talk about larger truths. He wasn't talking about the news that day. He was talking about these larger systems. And I think we all notice that that's kind of true. Who wants us to fight with each other? Who benefits when we're all fighting with each other?
It's so interesting that you say that. He was talking about these larger truths all of the time. Mike, I'm wondering from you, what might fans of George Carlin's find out about him from watching this that they maybe wouldn't already know?
I mean, it really does span so much of his life and work that even hardcore fans, people who feel like they've seen everything, will probably find things that are new here or new perspectives. I mean, one of the things that I was really interested in and just found very exciting as we were uncovering stuff is, you know, when he started off in a comedy team with Jack Burns, it was around the time that Lenny Bruce was big and the sort of quote unquote sick comics of that era, Mort Saul, Nicholson May, Jonathan Winters, and they were trying to kind of find their way in that world of these sort of edgier, more personal, more challenging comedians. And then they split up and George kind of tried to do that on his own and it didn't quite work. So he went toward a much more mainstream path to success and softened his material a lot and talked about different things that were more acceptable to the talk shows of the era. And he was always really going after very mainstream success. And then as the culture shifted and he just couldn't hold himself back any longer in not quite censoring himself, but not talking about the things he wanted to talk about, that journey to me is just so fascinating. But I think especially the early parts of his career, people really don't know much about. You know, he started off clean cut and a lot of people don't know that either. But it was a complex journey for him. And I think we tried to get into that.
Yeah. And I remember being introduced to him in the 90s. I saw a very different George Carlin than what I saw in this documentary. Early on, we're seeing him clean cut, hair, suit, tie, doing some vaudeville accent almost looked like a few times. And Judd, I'll ask you, was there anything that you learned about George Carlin while making this documentary that surprised you?
Well, one thing that really surprised me was someone who was trying to be mainstream in the beginning of his career. So he was very soft. And then he went very edgy. And then he was on a lot of drugs and he started having heart attacks and he made a conscious choice to make his act a little softer. And there's a moment in the documentary where he says, you can't really stress out about everything. And he had almost decided in a very 1980s way to not fight the power anymore. And so he's wearing sweaters and he's kind of corny and he's talking about his stuff and it's not that cutting edge anymore. It's still really interesting and funny. But then he sees Sam Kinison, and Sam Kinison is so out there and groundbreaking that it made him think, I got to get better. I don't want to be the goofy guy standing next to him. And suddenly he decided that he really wanted to see how much better he could become as a comedian. And I didn't know that that was the motivation behind this new change at the end of his life to go so much deeper and so much darker.
So I think one of the cool things about this documentary is the way in which it starts and George Carlin is actually narrating himself. When did you know you wanted him to be the narrator, essentially, of his own documentary?
I think once we realized that we had access to so much material of him and how much he had left behind in terms of interviews and personal recordings, we dug up a lot of stuff in working with the National Comedy Center, provided stuff. But George really hoarded things and hung on to all kinds of scraps of recordings of himself talking about his own life. And when we realized that we had that really rich archive that you kind of, as a documentary filmmaker, when you're making something about somebody who's not here, it's an archive that, you know, you dream about. And so once we knew that we could do that, I don't even think we really talked about it very much. It was just sort of course, that would be the approach.
You talk about like having access to all of this tape. Talk a little bit more in detail about the process of not just finding it all, these dozens or maybe hundreds of hours of tape, but like sifting through it with an editor or producer. Like, how did you actually go about figuring out how you were going to put it together once you had all of that tape? Because one of the things that impressed me the most with the documentary is just how focused it was, considering he had such a long life and career.
I mean, a lot of it is about our editor, Joe Beshenkovsky, who we worked with on the Gary Shandling documentary. He also did the recent John Belushi documentary, the Kurt Cobain documentary. He's one of these people that remembers every single thing that you have. So if you're like, did George ever talk about doing coke on a boat? He's like, I think there was an interview with Playboy magazine where he mentioned that once. And he is a brilliant editor and is just the key partner in our team. We talk early on about what a possible structure might be. And we knew that we needed to tell the story of America a little bit. in order to tell George's story, because it's how he's navigating what's happening politically in the country. So that was the first thought, which is it would have to have some sense of the history of the country for what he was saying to make any sense. And then there were two large periods in his life that we were trying to build this around, from, you know, growing up until he started comedy, and then had this change where he got he became an edgy comedian. He grew a beard, and he tossed off his corny attitude and went really edgy. And then he went to the Supreme Court because he had played some of his material during the day, and it became this giant fight. And we thought, well, that would be part one, and the rest of his life would be part two. And so in our heads, that's how we were able to think about the beginning of structure, knowing it would end with some sort of a collage of how his material applies to what's happening in the country today. And then it's just a very long process of how do you capture what it's like to be a comedian who's mainly doing variety shows, and it's really corny and you're not that happy with yourself? You know, which jokes, which routines, which conversations captured the feeling of that? And who should we interview that might be able to support it? And it's difficult because some of those times were 50 years ago. There's not a lot of people around who witnessed what he went through.
So one of the most interesting aspects of the documentary to me is Carlin's commitment to staying creatively sharp. Mike, talk to me about how you wanted to portray George Carlin, the artist.
I think one of the things that both Judd and I really enjoyed about learning more about George is, you know, how does an artist maintain their creativity and keep going forward over a long period of time? You know, to me, George is kind of like a great band or musician or something that, like, you know, maybe not every album is great, but he's able to continue pushing himself creatively over, you know, in his case, 50 years, which is really kind of extraordinary. By leaving behind so many recordings of his own thoughts and reflections, as well as all of his notes, you know, we were able to see that stuff and see where he was pulling ideas from. And so we really kind of looked to what we had of him. And especially one of the luxuries that we had was, you know, he was somebody who became celebrated as a sort of living legend or whatever while he was still alive. And he did a number of looking back kind of interviews, and he really assessed his own legacy and career and work. So he kind of did the work for us in a way. You know, all of those thoughts had already been sort of processed by him.
I'm a stand-up comic. It's a vulgar art. It's the people's art. I'll always be that. I'm nothing but a vulgar stand-up comedian, performer, show business guy. But I'm a writer too. There's an artist at work in here.
There aren't too many artists, and especially comedians, who are able to maintain relevance and to have such longevity. You know, there are plenty of folks who had a particularly fertile period that they were really clicking and connecting with the culture. George was able to do it in different ways over a really, really long period of time. And particularly in the sort of, you know, final phase of his career, the last 20 years of it, or 20 or more, really, he was able to create work and look at the deeper, bigger issues without being topical, but that his work got to the real core of what's going on in our country and what's going on in our world and what's going on really in terms of the human species in ways that really still resonate, and it doesn't feel stale or outdated.
Yeah. You know, George Carlin was known for using his humor to comment on political issues, as we're discussing right now. Somewhat connected to that was, you know, his love for deconstructing words. One of the prime examples being his famous seven dirty words bit, which we'll play a clip of right now.
Cursing, cussing, swearing, and all I could think of was shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. That was my original list. I knew it wasn't complete, but it was a starter set, you know?
So that bit became a central piece in the 1978 Supreme Court case on censorship. Judd, talk to me about the impact of this bit and of this case on the world of stand-up comedy.
I remember hearing it when I was a kid and just thinking it was the best thing I ever heard in my whole life. Because it was always a funny thing about being a kid, which was people would say, you can't say these words, or these words were bad. And even as a child, you thought, they're just words. It really doesn't matter at all. And he was the only adult calling that out in very specific, deep terms. And then he would say all the words. He would dissect what they mean from every possible angle. And he basically said that words only have the meaning which we give them. It's all about intent. And that was a big part of me learning how to be a comedian and learning how to be someone who tries to be funny, which is the way he examined all of those words. And also just the ridiculousness of how people try to distract us with what words are on TV while corporations and politicians are carving up the country. It always came back to financial interests doing whatever they want to do and not getting in trouble for it while they keep us occupied debating the words you can say on TV, which has nothing to do with the destruction of the country. Those were the things that George Carlin was trying to wake people up about.
The first time I heard the seven words, I probably was probably 15 years ago. So I was like 19. And a lot of those words, well, a few of them were words that like I could say on television or at work or in front of a classroom of children. And now 15 years later, it just feels like even more of those words you can kind of say on television without really too much penalty.
All of them on YouTube, right?
Yeah. Right? I mean, I say all of them at work. I also say a lot, many of them in front of my church going parents. They just lost a lot of their power. Like also many things about the world have gotten demonstrably worse.
Right.
And those two things aren't connected. George Carlin was right.
Yes. I mean, that is the funny thing, which is I always look at my kids and, you know, we cursed a little bit around the house. I would always just say, you sound silly. I didn't care. I'm just like, you just sound silly when you lean on it too much.
Yeah.
And my kids are fine. It didn't matter if we cursed or didn't curse. And I think that's what he was, you know, talking about. But it was also about certain conservative values and people trying to control how you thought.
Mm.
And he obviously was a free speech absolutist in a lot of ways. He came from a time when people went to jail for saying certain things on stage. And the concern was the government taking away your ability to use certain words and to speak freely. Times are different now, and we don't know what he would say about a world of algorithms, a world where ideas are forced into your computer through Facebook or YouTube or Twitter, and people are slowly, in a cult-like way, indoctrinated to all sorts of different ideas because there are these systems in place that they don't quite even understand are happening. And it is sad that we don't know what he would say about it.
So I want to talk about the ways in which Carlin was a little more nihilistic in his later years and how that kind of played into this theme, especially at this portion of his life. He said, I feel betrayed by all the bullshit in this country, feeling betrayed by religion, by institutions. That seemed really, really key to his worldview and to his comedic voice. And it kind of lent to his nihilism later in life. Can you talk about this theme a little bit in his life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that started very early on. There's a scene in the film where he talks about his first communion. You know, George was raised Irish Catholic, and he expected and had been told that when you get your first communion, you're going to have this incredible spiritual moment, and it didn't happen. And his reaction to that was, well, they're lying to me. And I think that he hung on to that really throughout his life. But the film also shows his hope and optimism in the early, late 60s, early 70s, after he makes his transition to the counterculture guy, how the Reagan era in the 80s kind of disillusioned him. And he saw what happened after the promise of the 60s counterculture and all of the hope that many people had during that period and how it was not fulfilled. And he got angry about it. He was very disappointed in his fellow humans and really made that the focus of the rest of his work.
We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car. Can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right?
There was certainly a difference in the way he talked about it from the beginning of his career towards the end. Because at the end, he's talking about making the death count higher and all that, kind of in a way that like only a grizzled, seasoned, like nihilistic veteran can really do. I want to play a clip for you and then see where y'all land on a question. Go ahead and play the Hasan Minhaj clip.
One of the things I'm still trying to figure out is, was Carlin ultimately a nihilist, or was he an actual optimist who was using comedy to display a nihilist worldview?
I'd love to hear where both of you land on this question.
Comedians are always looking for a stance that allows them to be really funny. So obviously that was a big part of this choice to become the darkest comedian that there probably ever has been. And he said, I want to root on the destruction of the human race. I'm just an observer and I'm going to laugh. I'm going to go to car races and root for the crashes. And that was a joke stance that he had, that we had screwed up the world and the environment. We're treating each other terribly. And my life is almost over. And I'm just going to sit here and laugh and applaud as everything goes down. And to me, I always took it like, it's something an old person would say to young people. Like I'm in my mid-50s. I'm not far from that point of view, which is, it's your world to fuck up, you know? And if you want to fuck it up, I'm going to sit here and laugh while you fuck it up, you idiot. So he probably thought, I'm going to go so dark, I hope it wakes someone up to say, well, maybe I will try to help the environment. Maybe I will pay attention to who I'm voting for. Maybe I will tune in to what's happening politically. I thought it went so dark, it flips to light. That's how I always took it. And I had seen him do those bits on Comic Relief when I was a young kid, and I was a production assistant there. And he did a bit about how golf was this terrible racist game.
Golf is an arrogant, elitist game, and it takes up entirely too much room in this country. Entirely too much room. Listen to me. You know how much room it takes up? 17,000 golf courses, about 150 acres each. That's 3 million acres. That's 4,800 square miles. Two Rhode Islands and a Delaware you could build for the homeless on the land that's currently devoted to this meaningless, mindless, arrogant, elitist, racist game. Racist game. Racist game.
And that, I always thought, was the core of this new attitude, which is to say what is awful in the harshest possible terms. And in the beginning, he would then have the solution, which was give the golf courses to the homeless. And then at some point, he's like, I'm not even going to give you the solution. You know, you guys need to figure it out yourselves. I'm just going to laugh at it. And to me, it was a positive thing. And he said, underneath, the cynic is a disappointed idealist. And that, to me, seems to be the truth. I don't think he wants anyone to get hurt. I don't think he ever really wants anyone to die. I think he's saying, are you really going to stay asleep? He's trying to punch you in the face to see if you'll wake up.
Yeah. How do you reconcile that with his words now being used in a way that isn't exactly doing what you just said, Judd? If you're sitting at a George Carlin special and he starts at the top being an idealist and saying that big idea and then going into kind of this longer monologue that isn't that, a lot of times we're not getting the big idea anymore. We're just getting the nihilism clips in a lot of ways of what people are posting in a way that's just, it's very stark. So much stark so that when I was watching your documentary, I remember thinking, I like this because it gives me the full context of George Carlin and not just this stodgy old timer who's yelling at us all to die in a tornado, you know? So how do you reconcile that, the fact that a lot of this is getting divorced from the core purpose of what he was trying to do?
Well, that's why we made it, I think, is to make that clear to people. And here's the arc of the creative expression which led to this. It's like if you just listen to like the Time Out of Mind record from Bob Dylan and you're like, wow, Bob Dylan is dark, but it used to be, you know, blowing in the wind. And so that is part of it. And we talked a lot about how different political groups would try to claim him. And we were very careful about what we chose and how we used it, because he was clearly a Democrat and he did have a lot of vicious criticisms of liberals and Democrats, but he was a Democrat. We knew where his heart was, But he still was just as rough on liberals as conservatives. Don't you think, Mike?
Completely. I think that there's a great bit called "The Planet is Fine, the People are Fucked" that's in the film.
I'm tired of fucking Earth Day. I'm tired of these self-righteous environmentalists, these white bourgeois liberals who think the only thing wrong with this country is there aren't enough bicycle paths. People trying to make the world safe for their Volvos.
You really see the full circle of him doing some of that nihilism as a character and being tongue-in-cheek, while also being critical of what he saw as self-interest on the left. That bit starts off, and it, you can hear in the audience, people think that he's criticizing environmentalists. And then as the bit builds, he is essentially saying that we have destroyed the planet. And that's clearly, that's a lefty cause. But he's able to wrap criticism of both ends of the political spectrum around a bigger idea that really speaks to his core values, which was we're destroying the planet and we're destroying ourselves.
Right.
Mike, I want to ask about Kelly Carlin, George's daughter. She's in the documentary and she's also an executive producer. What did she bring to this project?
Well, Kelly brought her personal story. You know, she's really the one who was there from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, who saw her parents' relationship and her father up close. You know, George was somebody who, he didn't have a whole lot of real close friends. He wasn't a super social guy. He kind of lived in his own head a lot. Mm. And so Kelly was able to bring her perspective on, especially in those first couple of decades of her life, starting in the 60s, some really personal stories and recollections and insight into who he was.
We want to cue up one piece of audio. It's a really great piece. And I'll ask you a question afterwards, but it's George interviewing Kelly, who can barely talk, about the Vietnam War.
You know, like apple?
Apple.
Apple.
Kelly, what do you think we can do about the Vietnam crisis? Can we get out of this mess? Would you say we're inextricably committed to a land war in Asia? Do you feel that a political solution is possible? Do you think that the Viet Cong should be bargained with?
Is that true?
Well, it's known as the National Liberation Front. And do you think we should recognize them across the conference table? No comment.
Judd, can you talk about what you learned about George as a dad from working with Kelly? And you famously being a dad who's worked with your daughters in the past. What did you learn about George as a dad here?
Well, one thing that was really interesting to me was that he didn't talk about his marriage and being a father and having a daughter in his act. That was not something that he wrote material about, which is a very strong choice to be an observational comic about politics, about life, about human behavior, and to not have the long bit about being a husband and being a parent. And I'm not sure exactly what it says, but it was a pretty strong boundary that he didn't really ever cross. You know, the world of a comedian, especially back then, was much different than it is today. He had to be on the road all the time. So obviously, you can do the math, the dangers of being on the road in the 1970s when you're the biggest comedian in the country is not great for a marriage. And the movie talks about his wife, Brenda, having problems with alcohol. A lot of it as a result of being left home alone and not being able to really pursue her own dreams. While trying to be a parent when your husband is gone most of the time. And then he's on cocaine and whatever else he's on. And Kelly's in the middle of this as a little girl, and the parents are going to war. And as a parent, I found that all pretty heartbreaking, especially when you hear something like that's as sweet as that. That's all a kid really wants, the presence of their parent. And the modern day comedians, you know, they make a lot more money, the successful ones, and they take a private jet and they'll go out Friday and Saturday, the big ones, and come home on Sunday and be home 4 or 5 days a week. And they have figured out how to have the lifestyle. But back then, he would go out for 3 weeks or 6 weeks in a row. And I think it really decimated their marriages and their ability to be healthy parents. And I have a lot of compassion for Kelly's strength as a person, because she's a really compassionate, loving person who's very involved in helping other people right now and in her work. And she's been very open about that. She didn't ever tell us, don't talk about it. She didn't try to protect her dad. She just told the honest story of what that was like. And also the fact that her dad and mom worked through it and they somehow survived it and came back to each other. And it's a pretty remarkable thing that they somehow made their marriage work through a lot of really brutal obstacles. The funny thing was, a few weeks before we locked picture, Kelly calls and says, I'm so sorry, but I found a big envelope of all their letters to each other over 30 years. And we were like, no, now we have to figure out, you know, what's in here and what we need to use. But what we saw was the letter he wrote her the day after he met her.
Oh.
The letter he wrote her after they made love for the first time. And then they were getting married a few months later. And then the letters evolved into them broke, trying to figure out how to ask her parents for money because they have $7 in the bank.
My gosh.
And then it becomes, he's a big comic. And then it becomes the problems of their substance problems and apology letters and letters describing really awful, awful times and fights. And then it turns back into this celebration of having survived and still loving each other, and that they were so close for having gone through so much together.
Judd, one thing you mentioned earlier on, y'all already knew that you wanted to use George Carlin's voice kind of as a relevant moment while showing the montage of all these things that have happened in the last few years, whether it be the death of George Floyd, the pandemic, all of that and beyond. And I thought it was an excellent way that y'all wove those pieces together. What else do you think that a documentary can do that fictional stories can't do?
It's very hard to show all of the different shades of a person. So if you see George Carlin, he's hilarious, but he's also in pain, and he's an addict, and then a great father, and the worst father, and a loving husband, and a nightmare husband, and an evolving person, and someone who wants to make people happy, but also is in a rage. And it's very hard to do that in a movie. So if, say, you made a movie about George Carlin, it would get corny. It would feel fake. There's just something about getting to the real footage and having people talk about their experiences with him that allows you to get to the deepest possible truth. So when we made the Gary Shandling documentary together, what I liked about it was I thought it was the natural extension of what Gary tried to do in his art. In the Larry Sanders Show, he dug deep into himself. And at some point after that, there was nowhere to go except the actual truth of who Gary was. There was nowhere deeper you could go in fiction. And I find I experience much more of what I'm searching for in my fascination with human beings in documentaries.
Judd, with this documentary and the Gary Shandling documentary, you're kind of becoming a comedy record keeper of sorts. What drives you to do this work, and like, how personal is it for you?
Well, I've always been a fan first with comedy. I remember when I was in sixth grade, I wrote a 30-page book report. It wasn't even a book report. It was just a biography about the Marx Brothers. But it wasn't an assignment. I just did it for myself. And I remember paying my friend Brand Eigen to write it with good penmanship because I had bad handwriting. So I must have always had an instinct to want to organize the journeys of these people that I admired. And I always want to know how people do it. I want to know why they got into it, how they do it, and what it's doing to them. Like, are they evolving as people? Are they evolving in their craft? Are they evolving in how they feel as human beings? Are you happy? Are you unhappy? Are you figuring it out? Are you getting closer to some sort of wisdom, or are you crashing? Mm. And so when you watch these things like the Johnny Depp trial or something like that, that's the thing I'm always fascinated in, which is the stress that the industry and creativity put you under, the types of people who are usually somewhat traumatized and broken who are interested in being creative, and how a really brutal business affects them. Some people find their strength, they grow. Other people crash, and then they grow. Some people just crash, period. But it's always something that I'm fascinated by, probably because it's what I'm going through in some way. How can I stay good at what I do over a lifetime? Mm-hmm. How can I stay sane? How can I not become a victim to my ego? How can I dig deeper? What am I digging for, and for what purpose? What's the point of making your 14th stand-up special? And so I'm sure I'm looking for answers for myself. And as a fan, I just like knowing. When we find a weird clip of him and Richard Pryor on the John Davidson show in the 60s, and they're both wearing sweaters and they're acting corny because they haven't figured out who they are, there is no one happier on earth to watch it than me.
Love it.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was really great.
Thank you both.
Thanks. That was fun.
It's a pleasure.
So, Brittany, let's get to our final takeaways from George Carlin's American Dream. What stood out to you?
Okay, so I loved watching four straight hours of George Carlin's life.
I agree.
And I didn't realize how seriously he took himself and his work as an artist.
Yes.
I just love the fact that he was just like all about getting better and giving as much of himself to comedy as he possibly could. Ronald, what stood out to you?
What I knew of Carlin was, you know, crotchety man with, you know, with a ponytail, with a white ponytail who would get up or like a mullet, whatever you want to that would get up on stage and, you know, speak truth. The other thing that gets me is like he knew he had to evolve if he wanted to stay relevant. And he did.
Yeah.
He heard the call and he really did. I wonder if other comedians will, if they watch a documentary like this, if they think about the impact of George Carlin, will they also think of ways in which that they also need to evolve in order to continue to stay relevant, you know, in the conversation that we're having today.
Mm-hmm. It was really amazing to see through the documentary that like the style of comedy that we're used to seeing today, you know, one comedian standing on stage for 60 to 90 minutes doing a special where they just sort of talk about like what's going on. Like that's something that he was a real architect of.
Yes. The way this documentary is laid out, it makes it easy for me to have those aha moments like, ah, okay, this all makes sense.
Just how much his style of comedy influenced what audiences even expect to see when they go to a comedy show now. It's pretty wild.
Oh, yes. I was thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think you probably did see the new Gerard Carmichael special.
I did. Rathaniel. Yes.
I watched Rathaniel before I watched the George Carlin documentary. And thinking back, like when I was watching the George Carlin documentary, I had Gerard Carmichael in mind because I was like, oh, like he's taking the baton kind of, you know what I mean? Like George Carlin is one of the architects of the HBO comedy special. And Gerard Carmichael is picking up that baton.
Agreed.
And taking the HBO comedy special and turning it into like a different type of performance. It took this very old art form and made it feel fresh to me. And I really felt like when I was watching the George Carlin documentary, that kind of artistic shift is something that we saw George Carlin do over and over and over again.
That's a great point. That brings us to the end of this episode of HBO Docs Club.
And if you haven't already, make sure you're subscribed to HBO Docs Club wherever you listen to podcasts. And of course, you can watch all the movies and shows we discuss on HBO Max.
We'll be back in 2 weeks to dive into the Emmy-winning documentary, The Apollo, directed by Roger Ross Williams. I promise, for real this time, it's The Apollo.
Until then, I'm Brittany Luce.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr.
Thanks for listening.
HBO Docs Club is a production of HBO and Pineapple Street Studios. It's hosted by me, Ronald Young Jr.
And me, Brittany Luce. Beyondrea July is our lead producer, and our associate producer is Maria Robin Somerville. Additional production support by Natalie Peart.
Darby Maloney is our editor. Hannes Brown is our engineer and composer. John Asante is our senior managing producer.
And our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. One of my favorite clips of his might have been from his sweater era when he talked about how when you clip your nails, like the first thing you want to do is pick them up and look at them individually. And I saw that when I was like 11 and I was like, wow, so deep, so true.